Judges 3. Now these are the nations which the Lord left, that he might test Israel by them, that is, all who had not known any of the wars in Canaan. This was only so that the generations of the children of Israel might be taught to know war, at least those who had not formerly known it, namely, five lords of the Philistines, all the Canaanites, the Sidonians, and the Hivites, who dwell in Mount Lebanon, from Mount Baal Hermon to the entrance of Hamath. And they were left, that he might test Israel by them, to know whether they would obey the commandments of the Lord, which he had commanded their fathers by the hand of Moses. Verse 5. Thus the children of Israel dwelt among the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And they took their daughters to be their wives, and gave their daughters to their sons, and they served their gods. So the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. They forgot the Lord, their God, and served the Baals and the Asherahs. Therefore the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he sold them into the hand of Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia. And the children of Israel served Cushan-Rishathaim 8 years. When the children of Israel cried out to the Lord raised up a deliverer for the children of Israel, who delivered them, Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he judged Israel. He went out to war, and the Lord delivered Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia, into his hand, and his hand prevailed over Cushan-Rishathaim. So the land had rest for 40 years. Then Othniel, the son of Kenaz, died. Verse 12. And the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord strengthened Eglon, king of Moab, against Israel, because they had done evil in the sight of the Lord. Then he had gathered to himself the people of Ammon and Amalek, went and defeated Israel, and took possessions of the city of palms. So the children of Israel served Eglon, king of Moab, 18 years. 15. But when the children of Israel cried out to the Lord raised up a deliverer for them, Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, a left-handed man. By him the children of Israel sent tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now Ehud made himself a dagger. It was double-edged and a cubit in length, and fastened it under his clothes on his right thigh. So he brought the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now Eglon was a very fat man. And when he had finished presenting the tribute, he sent away the people who had carried the tribute. But he himself turned back from the stone images that were at Gilgal and said, I have a secret message for you, O king. He said, keep silence. And all who attended him went out from him. So Ehud came to him. Now he was sitting upstairs in his cool private chamber. Then Ehud said, I have a message from God for you. So he arose from his seat. Then Ehud reached with his left hand, took the dagger from his right thigh, and thrust it into his belly. Even the hilt, when it had went in after the blade, and the fat closed over the blade, for he did not draw the dagger out of his belly, and his entrails came out. Then Ehud went out through the porch and shut the doors of the upper room behind him and locked them. Verse 24. When he had gone out, Eglon's servants came to look, and to their surprise, the doors of the upper room were locked. So they said, he is probably attending to his needs in the cool chamber. So they waited till they were embarrassed, and still he had not opened the doors of the upper room. Therefore they took the key and opened them, and there was their master fallen dead on the floor. 26. But Ehud had escaped while they delayed and passed beyond the stone images and escaped to Syria. And it happened when he arrived that he blew the trumpet in the mountains of Ephraim, and the children of Israel went down with him from the mountains, and he led them. Then he said to them, "Follow me, for the Lord has delivered your enemies, the Moabites, into your hand." So they went down after him, seized the fords of the Jordan, leading to Moab, and did not allow anyone to cross over. And at that time they killed about 10,000 men of Moab, all stout men of valor. Not a man escaped. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had rest for 80 years. 31. After him was Shamgar, the son of Anath, who killed 600 men of the Philistines with an ox goad, and he also delivered Israel.
Thank you, Dave. Appreciate you reading that for us. Judges chapter 3 is a somewhat gory chapter. I happen to enjoy it. Don't worry. A few get a little more gory, a bit parts later on in other chapters as well. not necessarily a gory person, but it's neat to see and read about men that are actually strong enough to say, hey, it may kill me, I'm going to go do this anyway, because it's the right thing to do. We don't see that very often anymore. It happens on occasion, but it's not very often. So it's always a pleasure just to, granted it was 3,000 years ago, but still, it's always neat to read. First of all, are there any questions regarding Judges chapter 3? Yes, Phil.
It isn't really a question. It's verses 6 and 7 are kind of like what we were talking about earlier before you got here on chapter 13 in Deuteronomy.
Mm-hmm. I'll look that up myself here. Oh, about the vows. Yes, and doing things that they should not have been doing. That's actually a consistent theme throughout the entire Israelite history for the judges, but it's something which they were specifically told not to do. Kate, you had your hand up.
I'm actually curious as to, is there a point why he pointed out that he was left-handed?
Yes. Okay. We'll discuss that. Yeah, it is an odd thing. It's like, what does it matter? What's the big deal about a left-handed person versus a right-handed person? We'll discuss that. No, actually, something separate from that. It's a little more earthy, fundamental as to why left hand right. Yes, Carmel.
Okay, so, in this one, it looks like this is a test. I mean, these are the nations that God allowed to remain. So, God didn't tell them, they didn't disobey God by letting these people exist when they shouldn't have necessarily. Or was that earlier? I've read all Judges, but
allows to remain is that, all right, there were two things that God gave the Israelites. One rule, a law they had to obey. When you go into this land, dispossess the people there. Get rid of all of them. Don't let any remain.
Right.
That was rule number one. Rule number two was that he was going to remove these people ahead of time and before them. That he would make them flee if they are willing to do rule number one. They were not willing to do rule number one. So he stopped. Yeah, this is Joshua.
Okay.
He stopped his decree of rule number two that he would make them all run away. Okay. He actually did more than just this. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the history of Philistines, we call them. They were conquering about the same time, about 100 years later, as Joshua. God actually assisted the Philistines. Now that seems odd, doesn't it? But he did. He helped them conquer a territory that the Israelites were not willing to conquer. He raised them up. All right? We know a little bit regarding this because the territory they took, the timing that they took it, and the few people they had alive when they were taking the territory. Now, direct you to my wonderful little map.
Ta-da!
Yay. We have this upper corner. It lists the judges that we discussed all the way up to now. Joshua, of course, number one. He was the biggest judge as far as most important one. Othniel, the nephew of Caleb.
Son-in-law
of Caleb. Yeah, he was son-in-law and nephew, kind of both. Anyway, we will discuss that. Othniel, he was the second judge. Then, of course, Ehud, or Chad, however you pronounce the name. He was the third. And Shamgar, number four. Something interesting happened right toward about the tail end, well, maybe last three quarters of Ehud's judgeship, you know, I call it. A people showed up. They were called invaders. You know, just term invader. You don't know what they're called. Oh, you mean the invaders. Well, in Hebrew, that word is Philistine. Called invaders, or Philistine, I don't pronounce it. It's invaders. Foreigners. People who don't belong. Well, the Philistine, or we now use the term Philistines, showed up. They conquered. My little map has them in red. This little territory, it's all dotted out. About, it took a chunk of Judah, and took a chunk of Dan's territory, and of course it lists out five in particular cities they took. Why was it important that God do this? That God allowed these people to come up and take this territory? Yes, Tammy.
Well, God has specifically told the Israelites, you know, get rid of all these people, you know, get rid of them. Move them out. Don't let them be in your land. And they've refused to. So since they refused to, God's like, well, this is my take on it. God's like, well, if you don't want to get rid of these people, I'm going to bring these people in and they will do it.
They will do it.
Well, the Israelites weren't given the land because of their righteousness. It was a judgment on the people.
The people who were in the land.
So
exactly.
They still needed
to get rid of.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. That's a wonderful point. The people, it's not that it didn't matter, but it was more important that God get rid of the people of Canaan, all the territory, the various, the Hivites, the Jebusites, and blah, 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 blah. Get rid of them, more important to do that than just give it to Israel. That was primary. Because Israel wasn't any great or good people. Philistines, at this point in time, are no good or bad. They're just better in a small respect because the people who are there are so horrid, God had to get rid of them. The Israelites, up to the Philistines showing up, they had 100 to 150 years to take all this territory before the Philistines even show up on the scene, the invaders. What territories did they not take? Well, it lists here, of course, a bunch of them. I'm not going to draw them all on the map. A few of them up here in the north is obviously the Philistine territory, which I don't recall who owned it at the time. Same people who owned it during Abraham's life. They still own their territory here. A few mountainous scattered spots here and there. Israelites only had a small portion of it, and they had 100 to 150 years to do this. It's a long time to not do your job. So you're looking at two generations going by at this point, and you're still not doing your job. Okay, if you won't do it, as Ashley and Tammy pointed out, I'll bring somebody up who will. And so the Philistines did it. How long did it take the Philistines to take this territory? Not that I'm expecting you to remember this. It doesn't look according to the Bible. It's somewhere between 50 to 100 years. Took them to take the territory. The territory is not that big. It's what we call the Gaza Strip today. It's not that large. We look at it today, and the people that were in control of it prior to them, yeah, they had chariots. They had a few other things, too, but they were no spectacular people. Why would it take Philistines so long to take this territory? Well, we have to look a little bit about the Philistine history to know something about them and their function in Israelite history. Philistines, they may know what their real name is.
Invaders.
Well said. It's actually, they have a couple of names. There's a Hebrew name for them. Not Philistines, by the way.
They were the original space invaders.
That's bad. Jeremiah records their actual, what they called them, as so does, it's also recorded in the book of Deuteronomy, which he was involved in doing part of compiling Deuteronomy. Chapter 2, verse 23, the Kaphortim, they're from the island of Kaphor. Where's Kaphor?
Crete,
what we call it today. They're basically descendants of a spin-off of Greek, but Crete is where they're actually from. Where's Crete in my little map? Well, somewhere out here off the map, this general area. So they came over to Philistine territory, Israelite territory, right? They just got on that boat and went straight there. Right? No. They had a little bit of war ahead of time. That's why it took them so long to take a small little strip. Because they lost the war. What war did they go to before they landed in Israel? Well, what's big countries right about here?
Egypt.
In 1190 BC, which is, by the way, they're supposedly, they said that they showed up with the territory of Israel and the Philistine territory was today, somewhere around 1190 to 1180. Not quite sure what year, but somewhere in that ballpark. Egypt records a battle with people they call the priest or peast or whatever. I don't pronounce the word. It's Egyptian. I don't really speak Egyptian. But it's basically invaders from the territory of water. They just came from water. They were ship-bearing people. And they came straight. Guess where they attacked? Egypt. Right about here on my map, which is around the area of the Nile, where the opening of the Nile is, roughly. They lost horribly. Egypt was able to repel them completely. Where are you going to go? Okay, that's called the least year of birth. It's not quite so hard. Because who is over here? Well, these guys are in the process of fighting a battle against who?
Israel.
Well, how easy is it to take over a territory when all the men, all the fighting men in a territory, are off somewhere else fighting? It's really easy. No one can stop you. You just literally park your ship, go on board, kill off a few guards here or there, but essentially the territory is yours. You may not have a lot of guys left. You probably lost quite a few ships in the Battle of Egypt, which lasted approximately a year to a year and a half, which is a long battle. They're not really sure how long it lasted. You parked over here. It was easy to take. And guess what? You exterminated the people who were there. It's now yours. The will of God is accomplished whether or not Israel does it or whether or not he raises somebody else to do it. It doesn't make any difference. His will still be accomplished. As a result, the people of Canaan got pushed away. Minusculely. Little tiny bits left here and there. Pockets. Okay, so that's a little history lesson of Philistine. Now, granted, there's a lot more history than that, but I'm not going to cover it now. It's not important. It'll come up later on in other succeeding chapters. Okay, so to answer some questions, or comment, actually, I should say, that well, that was a question, yeah. Carmel had asked. Before we go into all the stories, why was it important to lift out a left-handed man? Oh, well, why does that matter? Was it Carmel? Oh, Kate asked it. Kate asked it. I apologize. Kate asked it. Well, what's the actual wording in Hebrew? Well, I'm not going to sit there and read Hebrew to you. I'm not that good proliferant in it. The wording directly translated to English is a withered right hand. Now, what does that mean?
He had to use his left hand.
He had to use his left hand. That's all it means. Whether or not he was actually left-handed, I mean, we call left-handed, or something was wrong with his right hand, makes no difference. The point is, he was left-handed. Now, there are two predominant theories going on. One, something was wrong with his right hand, physically deformed, whatever the case may be.
Stroke.
Who knows? I guess it could be stroke. That theory, to my mind, actually holds less credence or less chance of being true than him actually just happened to be left-handed. Because what happens if you are a left-handed person born anywhere from about, 200 years ago and back? Does anybody know?
You're forced to be right-handed.
You don't have the option. You're left-handed. No, something's wrong with you. You live in a right-handed world. Well, guess what? Ehud was obviously not forced to be right-handed. Whether or not he was left-handed or not, doesn't make a difference. He wasn't forced to be right-handed. If you're right-handed and you're a soldier, where do you carry your sword or on your left side?
They
would have checked his left side. Yeah, okay, because in Moabite life,
it
didn't look withered. If it looked withered, it may have drawn attention to say, oh, let's check his right side just in case, because his right hand doesn't work. So my opinion, and I would tend to agree with this, granted I didn't come up with the opinion, somebody else did, but I would tend to agree with it. I don't think it was physically damaged rather just didn't work like a right-handed person's hand works. That's my belief.
Is it, could there be a meaning to that? For example, if he was a Benjamite, it means son of the right hand.
Yes.
But he's not, he's actually doesn't, he can't use,
can't
his,
use
right
his right hand.
But is there a spiritual thing here? Because it says Yahweh raised up them a savior. Is it because it's not in his own strength? He's not, as the son of the right hand, that would have a position of favor, but mm-hmm. he's actually now, what's the word, hampered by the fact that he...
Okay.
Yeah, just, is there,
I,
is
I think
there
I, kind I think
of
I see where you're going.
Word play going on here.
It,
I'm just wondering.
It very well could be because Benjamin, the tribe itself, we discover later on in Judges, are known for left-handed soldiers. Right. That's what the tribe primarily did, which is quite ironic to have a name that means "son of my right hand" if you're left-handed. It's quite odd to have such a title. I'm inclined to partially believe what you're saying, if I understand what you're discussing, Susan, is that there is some kind of a symbolism that God's using with the last born of Israel being the son of my right hand, which is strength, and making him instead left-handed, which is, what is left-handed? Do you remember what left means, right versus left? Come on, you know right and left. Come on. Someone
the sheep and the goats. You know the two.
Yes, right hand yeah. brings you in.
Right hand brings you in.
Bring you in.
What does the left hand do?
The shield.
Shields you. All right. There is probably some metaphor going on there that's being used as to why Benjamin, son of my right hand, which is, of course, to draw you in, is left-handed, your protector instead. I have not explored it to the extent that that could go. That could go much more elaborate than what I'm understanding at the moment.
Ephraim and Manasseh.
Or flipped, right. There's a lot of questions there, and I can't answer enough of it to give you a definite, hold on, 1% of time. We'll go for Jeff first. Yes.
Very simple explanation to it.
Go ahead.
Boxing, as in sword fighting, right-handers against left-handers are always having an advantage for the left-hander. Because you can go in on their unprotected side. So if someone is at your right hand and they're left-handed, they'll be jabbing that way.
Mm-hmm.
You would have to be jabbing out that way if you're right-handed versus the other one would be going with strength.
Sure, across, good.
That side. So they would have your right side.
That would be makes a lot of sense for military purposes. And that would be, it could be something as simple as that. You had a comment.
They would have their shield in their right hand.
Right, rather than left. In which the other person, yes.
That had to be correct. That's the message. When the drawer comes in, the shield doesn't necessarily, it's something, you got the sword in one of his hands.
Right.
Okay, so more the way of looking at that, if the Messiah is the one that brings you in and protects you, the right hand protects you, that's what Pesach is all about, then the left hand must have a sword out there. Where's the shield?
Right.
The right hand also can be the shield. If the Messiah is a shield bringing you in, you're protected on the right side from the fiery darts of the devil. There's different ways of looking at this thing.
Right.
So the sword could be having it on the left hand.
You can. Well, I realize that fundamentally, yes, you can obviously switch hands back and forth.
I think God was ambidextrous.
Weapons on the right hand.
Nine left. That's true. Go from both directions. In which case, what does that mean? Weapons on right and left.
Yeah.
What's your defense?
There
isn't one.
Weapons. What is it? Weapons of righteousness on the
right
hand and on the
left. Yeah. If you have right and left hand weapons,
you
don't have a shield, do you?
You don't need it, apparently.
You don't need a shield, do you? Anyway, I won't go there now. Minor. Okay. Anyway, so where was I? Okay. That was just right hand, left handed one. Ehud happened to be left handed. Yes, he put his sword on his right hand side. Why? Because what in Moabite tradition, if you're left handed, that doesn't exist. You were actually right handed by definition, so they would have only checked his left side. They didn't. Simple as that. Fundamental. I won't go beyond that. Other than the point. Whether or not his right hand was physically damaged or just the fact that he was left-handed. I'm inclined to believe just left-handed because most of Benjamin was all left-handed as far as their fighting men, and they were quite talented at fighting and killing. We will learn that later on when they do things they should have been doing. Okay, now I'm going to go ahead and just go straight through this because I don't want to waste too much time discussing on details. Okay, reason given. What are the two reasons given as to why God allowed these other nations to thrive and exist.
What other nations?
Nations other than Israel. You have the Philistines are obviously around. You have a few of the Canaanite pockets, the Hivites, the Jebusites, and various other people around. What were the reasons given in chapter 3?
Verse 4, to test.
What were they testing?
Testing the Israelites to see whether they would obey the Lord's command, which he had given their forefathers to Moses.
Right. And what was Samuel's also opinion that he threw in there as well? So that they would know war. Earlier on.
How to fight.
Two reasons. How to fight, and two, will you believe and follow God? Simple. Fundamental.
Every generation has to learn to fight against the first battles.
There's obviously practical reasons as to why.
Right.
Will you follow God? That's each of us has a decision.
You go to war.
And will you go to war? Learn how to go to war, because you're going to need to. Those two reasons given. I won't go through every detail, but obviously the people did not follow what they were supposed to be following. They wound up following Baals and Ashtoreth trees and various other things under the sun. Not that terribly important. Well, it is, but it's not for my current point. We have a pattern that Samuel pointed out, chapter 1 of Judges. 1 or 2, anyway. We have a pattern of national sin spawns what's next?
Bondage.
Yep, bondage or foreign domination, same difference. What's the third step the Israelite goes through? This happens to every judge. What's that?
They cry out.
Cry out to the Lord, that's correct. Mm-hmm. And what's the fourth one?
He sends somebody
to deliver them. And what's the fifth? What do they get as a result?
Years of peace.
Years of peace. And then what happens? See step one. Just go over again. Never ending. Okay, after we have a couple years of peace, now we go to national sin again. Now, are we discussing individual sin? No. You as an individual is one thing, and that's what we have, the high priest, the priesthood for. You have your own sins you deal with. We're discussing national sin as a whole. Large groups of people disagreeing or not following God.
Acceptance of breaking God's law.
Exactly. Then it is considered okay. It happens to all of us. It's a part of being in nature, human nature. We do that. We have a period of, you know what, I'm doing great. Life's wonderful. You know, it's not that big of a deal. This is just the one time. Whatever it be, it doesn't make a difference. And then that one time goes a little bit more, a few more times. And, of course, we have repercussions. Repercussions last a while.
Amen.
They last a while. What's the key to ending a repercussion?
Crying out to God.
At what point are you willing to tolerate the repercussion before you finally said, oh, by the way, God, I need help. I'm in trouble. This is more than I can handle. And then what does he do? Send someone to help you. Now, whether or not it's your personal life, obviously everyone differs a little bit. But this is how the function of the pattern that we have given to us in Joshua and Judges for almost 400 years of this consistent, never-ending pattern. To teach you something. What does it teach you? Does it teach you never to sin?
No.
Teaches
the way out.
Teaches the way out. Teaches you to cry out. That's the object.
And he gives deliverance.
Yeah, he'll give deliverance.
Whether or not you actually change.
You may not deserve it.
You may not change.
You may go back.
The mercy of God.
But the point is, how long is it going to take for you to allow to suffer and continue through this punishment, though you deserve it, before you'll say, okay, God, I need help. I've gone too far. This is too much for me. Please help me. The point is, learn to cry out. How long did it take Israel to learn to cry out against Cushan Rishathaim, king of Aram? 8 years. That's a long time.
It gets worse.
I know, it's a lot worse. 8 years of saying, oh, okay, find the gods, we need help. 8 years of misery. That's a long time to suffer through anything. Most of us would give up. A lot earlier than 8 years. But so they stuck with 8 years. And what happened once they cried out? Othniel. Othniel, how you pronounce the name. Rose him up. And what did Othniel do? He got his swords together. He got his men together. He went out, did battle, and crushed them. Essentially. Doesn't give a whole lot of detail, but he conquered them. He wiped out the enemies. And they had peace for how many years?
40.
Actually, they had peace for 32. Because how many years were they miserable? 8. So Othniel, by the way, this is consistent throughout the entire book of Judges. The years of peace, they rattle off 40 years, 80 years, 10 years, 14 years, 23 years. It also includes the years that they were miserable is in that time span. So just be aware that's the case. Just want you to be familiar with that. So Othniel was total, by the way, Joshua put 28 years. We didn't discuss that, but he was 28 years. He was judge. Othniel was 40 years total. 8 years. They were miserable. So he was actually had peace for 32 years. All right. Ehud. I'm sorry if you can't read that very well. I have small handwriting. 40. No, I may just made it worse. No, I won't. It's 40. Trust me. Ehud. How many years were they in misery?
18
years. That's even longer. Holy cow. How many years of peace did they get out of that 18 years of misery?
80.
80 total. How many years were actually peaceful?
62.
Underline the peace years. I like those. Shamgar. We're just going through the life real quick. Shamgar, the last judge. Does it say how many years?
No.
No. Why?
Peace?
He didn't actually complete a full year. Shamgar was only for a few months, by the way. It was the tail end of Ehud's life. Shamgar for a couple of months. And then, who came up right after him? Which we haven't read yet. Chapter 4.
Yeah.
Deborah. We like her. So Shamgar will give him less than 1 year. Did they get a lot of peace out of Shamgar's work?
It says he delivered also Israel. So there's something that chaos took place inside his time.
What took place inside his time?
Philistines.
Woo! Philistines show up. This little red spot, which I'm now coloring green, because I have a green pen. Philistines show up during the tail end of Ehud's life, and while Shamgar was around. Who was Shamgar, by the way?
Anna.
Anna. Who was he? What tribe was he from? Do we know?
Levi.
Okay. Levi. Was he just any Levi? No, he was actually a farmer. Surprisingly enough, Shamgar was a farmer in Levi. He was a Levite, because that's his father was Levi. By the way, this is Jewish tradition, by the way. They based it off of Anazim, who was a Levite, who was, they think he was actually his father. They're just using the similar words, based on why they believe he's Levite. He was in charge of this territory. Actually, Christ, he was in charge. He lived in this territory somewhere around, guess where?
Jerusalem.
We recall that most of the Levites were concentrated around Jerusalem. Most of the cities were. There were a few Levites scattered in other territories, if you recall, in Joshua. They were scattered throughout. They had various cities in various little sections. While he happened to be an area where, guess who lived? Philistines. He ran across them. Because he lived there. That's the area that he lived at. Now, it says he delivered all of Israel. Well, actually, technically, he delivered a section of Israel, which would be this territory along here. Which, that's pretty much all of Israel. It's all of occupied Israel, at least at the flat point in time. Who was Ehud tribe? What was he from? It actually tells you.
Benjamin.
I'm going to write short Ben up here for short. And Othniel, what tribe was he from?
Judah.
We already know Josh was from tribe Ephraim. So you have these three judges early on. Where territory were they all living around. Where the action was. If there's no action, we don't read about them. They live around where all the action is. Okay, so we got a little bit of history of who these people are. I'm going to fly through a little bit because I'm dragging my time a little bit. I shouldn't be. By the way, total number of years of peace versus years of peace. Sorry, peace versus war or misery. There were 110 years of occupation during the 370. So they had 260 years of happiness while 110 years of misery. The point I want to point that out is just that peace was overwhelming in their lives compared to war and misery. That's what you want. That's what all of us want. We want peace to be in our lives more so than misery, right? And that's ideal. That's what we are after. Verse 12. We're going to discuss all these various details. Verse 12. God strengthened Eglon with 10 clans or 10,000 men, however you wish to word it. At this point in time, it may have been actually thousands, so we're not quite sure, of men. And what did Eglon do? Who is Eglon? Who is these people?
Moabites.
Where does Moab live?
East of
See, this is a red section over here. I have like partially covered up Reuben and it's a little further south, the Dead Sea. I have the little lines dotted ending over here. That's because Moab's actually way out here. It's a lot bigger. If you recall...
That's modern day Jordan?
South. A little south of Jordan. It's kind of mixed between Jordan and Saudi Arabia kind of combo. The one thing I forgot to mention beforehand, I apologize. Othniel. Who was that king? Does it say what country he was from? It's not on my map. The country's too far away. That might give you a hint. What country does it say he was from? The Kush... What's his name? Kushan...
Kushan
Rish.
Akhayim.
What
was... Akhayim. It was Mesopotamia.
Where is that area?
Iraq.
More importantly, wasn't quite that far away, but yes, you're right. It's in the territory of Iraq, more closer to Syria, though. Which, in my little scale map of Israel, I realize that, yes, Syria does technically border this spot today, but he wasn't actually living there. He's actually about here, a little further away. That's where his territory was. Why was it so easy for Othniel to get out of bondage of these people? Easy, meaning he was able to do it. They're a long ways away. How do you send reinforcements? They'll be there in a month. Oh, you're under attack? Yeah, we'll send them right away. Yeah, it takes a while. He was, obviously, like most of Mesopotamia, they're in the game of domination. The goal is to dominate the main trade routes going from their territory to Egypt. And Israel's right in the middle of that game. So they send troops out here to conquer it. Shouldn't be that hard. They were successful for 8 years.
It goes toward the Euphrates River.
Right. Well, yeah, it's a little...
Yeah, it's quite a ways.
You're looking at a trek to get people to travel that distance, especially if you're getting an army up on notice. So it's not that difficult for Othniel to succeed. Not that it wasn't important. He did a great job, but the point is, he can do it. Ehud, we already pointed out where Moab was. What did it say that Moab, Eglon, the king, did? Besides the fact he would attack him.
He went out and defeated Israel, capturing the city of date palms.
What's that? What city date palms?
Jericho.
Sort of, very close to it. Jericho doesn't exist anymore, by the way. Joshua destroyed it. And Jericho is not rebuilt until...
No.
This first king's era, about the time of which David's alive.
About to have a lot of palms.
That's 400 years from now. What's right next to Jericho? Just a hair north of it. We're going to call it a small community called City of Palms. Actually, it's Date Palms. I believe it's just north. I could be wrong on that one. It's just a hair north of Jericho. It's a small community. It's not a city. It's not a major metropolis like Jericho was. It was a subset. It was a small little community off the side of it. Yes, it made money off of Jericho like everybody else does. It was an area right there near the same spot. It wasn't actually Jericho itself, but it might as well have been in the same plain territory. Jericho, was, like I said, wasn't built until a few hundred years later. So what did he do? He crossed Reuben's territory.
To get
there. Didn't he? Reuben owned all of this section. Moab had to travel through Reuben's territory, because they were further east than Reuben, mostly, a little further south. Through the territory, cross the Jordan, and take that little city, little town.
To capture the territory of Reuben.
Yeah.
In his process.
He had to capture the territory of Reuben to do it.
It became known as Moab now.
Reuben still exists up to this point. It exists later on. However, Reuben is not strong enough to defeat a nation all by itself. It wasn't. It was one tribe. It wasn't the biggest tribe. It was just one tribe. Moab was able to walk literally right through them. This took years, by the way. This wasn't an instantaneous, oh, Joshua dead, bless up, Moab's on your death's doorstep. No. It took many years for this process to occur. Generations come and go. Small battles come and go. But Moab obviously worked their way up across Reuben to cross the Jordan and take Jericho, or the area of Jericho. And like we already mentioned before, there were 18 years that he had that territory. Let's see, discuss later on how many men he did it with. I believe it says how many men died. Do you recall how many men it says? I think I rattled off. It was 10, either 10 clans or 10,000. Why does it say all of Israel?
Go ahead. What'd you say?
Why does it say all of Israel, that he would dominate it, or he was in control of, or he ruled over all of Israel? Because he ruled over two of the most dominant tribes of Israel.
Ephraim and Judah.
Ephraim and Judah are still in their infancy at this point, as far as their strength, what they own. They have their own small battles they're continuously fighting. He obviously ruled over Benjamin, because that's actually Benjamin's territory. He didn't have to conquer literally every square inch. Did Israel conquer every square inch of Canaan? No. Did they own Canaan? Well, yes. But they didn't conquer every square inch, did they? No. Moab didn't have to conquer every square inch, did he? Just conquer the area that actually matters. What area matters to Ephraim and Judah and Benjamin? Well, the one area they get every single dime of their trade. The spot where all the caravans cross to go down to Egypt.
The city of the date of palms?
Jericho. That's how Jericho built its name, was through trade. It was a destination you go to, sell your goods, and move on. The area itself, just because Jericho fell, the area still existed. So that Moab didn't have to conquer every square inch of Israel, did he? He just had to conquer what actually mattered to them at that time. The trade routes. That's what he did. And he made a lot of money doing it.
That's what he taxed them.
That's what he taxed them. They had to pay tributes. I'm going to move on a little faster here. I apologize. Ehud, Benjamin, he relied on what? What was the difference between him and Othniel's tactics or strategy? What did Othniel do that Ehud didn't do, and vice versa? Anybody recall?
Othniel went to battle, and
Ehud did it on assassination. It was more clever, wasn't he? Not to say Othniel was not clever. It's just what Ehud relied on versus what Othniel relied on. Othniel's attack, which granted, Othniel could not have traveled from Judah all the way to Syria to assassinate a king and then come all the way back to fight a battle. So there's obviously logistics Othniel could never have done. Ehud was able to do something that Othniel was unable to do. Because guess what? After this battle, guess who still exists? Well, Othniel's territory, Othniel's system, his method, Syria or Mesopotamia, still exists. It's still a major powerhouse. Just because you killed a few soldiers doesn't do anything to the country. Ehud, however, it's the same principle of cutting off the head, the snake, the whole body dies. He took out a king, which how many years of peace did they get? Well, 62, but 80. How many years of peace did they get from Moab?
18.
No, years of peace. The Moab never came back again. How many years before Moab showed up again on the scene?
32. Wasn't
it
32 years?
32 years? No.
Until maybe the time of
David or Saul. How many years later is that? Hundreds of years. Hundreds of years go by before Moab ever shows up their head again. It was a devastating blow to Moab to lose not only their king, but all their most important fighting soldiers.
Fighting soldiers, 10,000.
That's a big blow. And then Moab wasn't some huge country like Syria or Mesopotamia was. It was small. It can't afford a major blow. It's a descendant of Lot. They weren't around that many years. I've got a couple hundred years now, but they haven't been around forever. They've been slowly growing. So was Ammon. They weren't around for thousands of years, practically. For a few hundred. They're not that big of tribes. Doesn't take that hard to knock them out. What was the method that Ehud did after he... I love this story. He goes in... I know it's gory, and that's the reason I love it. It's not because it's gory. It's because of the character and what he did. He goes in. He gives this tribute of Israelite territory. Now, granted, mostly it's from Ephraim, Benjamin, Judah. We don't know how much of the tribute actually came from the northern tribes. Probably not a whole lot, because Moab really didn't dominate up here. Who dominated the northern tribes, by the way, at this point? Well, they had more influence from Ammon right over here on our map than they did Moab way down at the bottom end. So Moab, as far as Asher is concerned, or Naphtali is concerned, Moab is a nobody. Their issue is Ammon, or Syria coming back down again. They probably didn't contribute a lot to the tax that Moab was imposing upon these few tribes. They came across, and who came across? He gave him this tax, he gave him the requirement, and guess what he did? He went back. He goes back to Israel. King's still alive. Goes back to Israel. Then, after he gets all of his people, the tributary people, across the Jordan, then what does he do? King, I have a message for you. He's all by himself. Ehud does not have to worry about trying to get his people back. He's a one-man job now. Perfect assassin. Perfect. He got all those people there, got them back. The Moabites are happy. Nobody's complaining. He's all by himself. He only has to worry about himself. Fly buzzing around my head. So he gets a king. And this king says, silence! We don't know whether he says silence to Ehud or silence to everybody else. Judaism gives him the benefit of the doubt and says he's saying silence to everybody else because this is really important. I don't know if he did or didn't. They have reasons. Because of Ruth is the reason they give him the benefit of the doubt, because Ruth is one of his descendants. But we won't go there right now. So they all go back. Okay, they all go back. Go back. Ehud goes to his upper chambers, and just tries to talk to the king. I have a message for you. What does the king do? Again, Jewish tradition, the king is the one who stands up, though the wording doesn't specify who it actually is, because Ehud says it's from God. Does Moab... The Moabites, do they know who God is, the God of Israel? Yes, they do. How do they know him?
Lot.
Lot. Moabites are descendants of Lot. They know Lot. They know Abraham. They know the story. They also heard everything that happened to the Israelites in Egypt as they were crossing, what happened to the Egyptians. They know the whole details. They fought a couple of battles a little bit with Moses on occasion. Well, they weren't quite too pleased with they were walking through their territory. They know who God is. They're afraid of him. They fear him, just like they should. So we don't know whether the king stands up or Ehud stands up, but one of them do. And of course, Ehud grabs his dagger and thrusts it into his belly. King dies. One wording, which is a little bit questionable, it points out what comes out of the... I know it's a little gory. What comes out of the king?
Entrails.
What's the actual word itself? It's his excrement. Why is that important? Why did the Bible record that? That's gross, right? It's because of what his servants do. If you have excrement pouring out of you, what does it do to the air? It stinks. And when your servants come to your cool upper chamber, which is the code word for bathroom, what we would call it today, and what do they smell at the outside of the doors?
Yeah. It ain't
rope. He's relieving himself. It gives Ehud time to escape because the servants smell the fact he's going to the bathroom.
That's how the old word is.
Yeah. It smells like he's going to the bathroom. So the servants give him time, believing he's going to the restroom. So he's in the chamber, leave him alone. He has Ehud all the time he needs to flee. Now, of course, English sanitizes it a little bit, uses his entrails, but the actual word is his waste is what comes out, the excrement, the soil, whatever you wish to call it. It affects and gives Ehud his method of escape, because it delays his servants. What if the servants had knocked on the door and didn't smell anything, didn't know what was going on, and just unlocked it? Would Ehud have time to escape?
No.
Probably not. What would have happened if he didn't escape? He probably would have died, and what would have happened? Would not have rallied the troops. The people and the children of Israel who were in the hills of Ephraim, the soldiers that were waiting there, they would never know. They'd be waiting and waiting and waiting. As far as they know, his method or his goal was unsuccessful. The king probably was still alive. And Ehud was caught and he was killed. And so what did they all do? They would all go back home. They can't defeat Moab. Obviously, Moab's better than they are. So it was important that Ehud escape so that he can rally the troops, get the message out that Moab's been delivered, their king's toast, let's go take him. And they do. It was brilliant. It was brilliant strategy. And what did they do? Not only that, they actually one more little step, which I thought was kind of cool. They didn't just come out and attack, did they? No. What did they take first?
The train track.
In particular, the route. What about that route? See this big blue... Well, it was big blue. The River Jordan. How do you cross the River Jordan? By little sections in which they have bridges or whatever you happen to be able to cross. What happens if you can't cross the River Jordan? Well, you're stuck on the side that you're on because you can't cross it. So they took the River Jordan, or the area which you would cross. So most likely either in the north, south, doesn't make any difference. They took the fords, what it's called, or the territory which Moab soldiers would cross over with. They took that, and what did that effectively do to those soldiers?
Isolated.
They can't go home. You got, oh wait, what's it called? The ducks in a barrel, or I don't know how. What was the word off the top of my head? They're sitting ducks. Thank you. Same thing. Fish in a barrel. That was the word. Thank you. I was trying to think what the word was. It's not ducks. It's, yeah, fish in a barrel. Thank you. Yeah, I'll work on my English idiocisms later. So fish in a barrel or sitting ducks. They're toasted. There's nothing they can do about it. They literally just die. And what's so important? Why does it say that the men of valor was over here, were in Israel at the time for 8 years? Oh, sorry, 18 years, I apologize. 18 years. Why would Moab send its best, most powerful, strongest men to live and dwell in this little territory?
A presence.
Presence. Sort of. They didn't need to expand, though.
To keep them subdued.
Keep them subdued. Why couldn't Moab just send any ordinary soldiers?
Because they would maybe get comfortable, mingle with the people there, and lose their loyalty.
Well, that could be. I'm not too privy to that. But if you, as a small, tiny, minute country, are desiring to make yourself look overwhelming and powerful,
send your elite force.
Send your very best to make it look like you're really elite and powerful, huh? Did the king of Mesopotamia or Assyria, did he have to send his very best soldiers? Well, of course not. He didn't need to. He was already big and powerful. He wasn't trying to impress anyone. He wasn't trying to conquer an entire nation by taking only one tiny little town. Moab needed to look really big and really powerful. So they did the best men they could possibly muster up. Let them sit in that small little area and make it look or appear like you don't have a choice. You have to pay tribute because we're so strong.
Maybe they were lobbyists.
Lobbyists? Force the people to, was it the strong protection money? I guess that's what it's called, yes. Little mafia going on there.
To ask you,
yes, sir.
Ahead of the time. Did you find out where that city of Sisera is? Escape to that one.
Oh, no, I have not. I have never found anybody to cross. Yeah, he couldn't cross Jordan yet. I was told that it's near a rock quarry area, so it had to be really close to the Jordan River.
Yeah.
But I can't pinpoint exactly where it's at, because obviously rock quarries are usually close to rivers.
My person says when he went back out, when Ehud went back out, it says he went to the quarries.
Right. Which is another word for the...
Right, after reaching the quarries at Kilgal, then he went back to the king to kill him.
Right. It's
That's the first part. I was wondering when he escaped from first place.
When he escaped. The stone images escaped to
the mountains of Ephraim.
It could be the mountains of Ephraim. Whatever it is, it's outside the territory of Moab, they're no longer in control. It's a rock quarry area.
Yeah.
Where are the mountains of Ephraim? If it's in Mount Ephraim, where it rock stone images. Where is mountains of Ephraim at? Well, Ephraim is mostly a whole mountain range. That's the whole territory. That's all along here is a mountain range. We're actually a little closer there. So he was probably within what we would call a few miles of the Jordan River. That's where the mountain ranges typically are. Jordan River, a couple miles west, a couple miles east, you have mountain ranges start showing up. Well, west in particular. I don't know where, though. It's a good question. I looked it up. I couldn't find out the exact location. It probably was in Ephraim territory. It makes logical sense because that's where he routed the troops from. Let's see. Next comment. Moving on. I mentioned they had 60 years of actual peaceful. Shamgar. We'll discuss him now because we're pretty much done with Ehud. We had 62 years as a result of his conquest of Moab. We already mentioned Shamgar was a Levite. At least that's what he believed to be a Levite. Ruled only for a few months. What's an ox goad?
So you used to poke the oxen with to keep them going.
That's one of the ends. What's the other end of the ox goad for? Oh, sorry. You know what ox goad looks like? My maps. Well, that's all right. Well, I'll draw it down. I can draw it down here. It's... Yeah, exactly. It's got a big fat end on one end and like a pointy end on the other end.
And it's got spikes.
That's true. It does have spikes.
Taking out the wide end.
Yeah.
Metal spikes. The goad.
Okay. So, what do you use it for? He's right. To poke goads, oxes along to allow them to travel, keep them going. Why would you want it? Well, they're plowing fields. You have to keep them in control. Yes, we have reins and whatnot. You tie them to an ox, you strap them to your body, and what happens if the ox gets spooked? You're on for a ride. Have fun. You figure it out quickly if the ox is upset with you. So a relatively large item, actually. So I've been told it's upwards of 8 feet long in some designs because of the size of ox and where the operator is behind the ox or near it. Or it may be in front of the ox. It's debatable. They have small ones for in front of the ox. I don't really know. I'm not a farmer. I apologize, but I'm just not. Either way, you think a weapon that big, at a broad end here and a pointy end there. By the way, they use both ends. It's not just one end. They use both ends. See, one end, these spikes are not super sharp because you don't want to kill your animal. I mean, that's pointless. They're actually relatively dull. Relatively. I mean, they're half inch, three quarters of an inch diameter on one end, which is the dull end, little flat tips. You're not trying to kill an animal. You're trying to prod them along. Make a point, yes. You can use both ends. The point is you can use both ends. And this other pointy end, which is even more dull, for distance poking.
How do you hold on to the other?
I have not personally taken a photograph of one, but I saw a small drawing. There was actually, the drawing at least it showed, there was actually a little handle that went through this end. I'm not drawing 3D very well, but there was a handle that went through that end that they would hold on to. But that's what the drawing was. I didn't see a photo, so I can't swear to it for sure. But you use both ends. Did this item, if it actually is in fact 8 feet long, look strong enough to kill 600 invaders?
If you swung it around
a few times and smacked some heads with it, yeah, you can kill 600 men.
Doesn't say he might have.
Not all at once. It's not 600 on one. So I just realized that. What was that?
With the jawbone of a ass, killed a whole lot.
Killed a whole lot of people. That's true.
1,000.
And that's true. He did it. Did Shamgar do it? I don't know. He may have.
Well, the only one given the credit that much muscle was
Samson. And there's nothing that says Shamgar was as equal in strength or capability of Samson. He may have. Don't get me wrong. He may have did 600 on one and successfully came out alive. Or he may have died during the process. I don't know.
He might have had some men with him.
He may have had some men with him. But it says he killed it with an ox goad. So unless they all had ox goads, I'm not quite sure. I don't know. I don't know for sure. The point, yeah, for farmers.
This is weapon of choice. It's very windy and it's off.
It's one of the reasons why they argue he was actually, though he was from tribe of Levi, he was probably a farmer in the area of Levi, tilling the ground near a Levite town or city. Because Levi owned the small territories around their cities. He was probably in that trade. One of the reasons he was probably successful at wielding an ox goad enough to kill at least 600 opponents. Yes, Jeff.
Well, I mean, what kind of a weapon do you need when you're dealing with a bunch of cretins?
Oh, that was bad. I like that. The hot room with that one.
The words right out of his mouth. Cretans are a lot like Klingons. They're pretty mean. They're known to be violent.
Pretty cruel, yeah.
Cruel and pretty dumb as well.
Pretty dumb as well. So yes, Shamgar was. He could have died in the process of killing these 600 guys. Probably why he only was successful for a few months out of his life. I don't know. But he only ruled for a few months, tried to stop the invaders for a few months of his life before whatever happened to him. I presume he died. Yes.
Well, it says he also delivered Israel. It doesn't say he went down trying.
Exactly. It doesn't. It doesn't specify what happened to him. But either way, he doesn't have any years associated with him. He's probably at some point in time during Ehud's life. Yes, Kate, you had a...
I was thinking, yeah, they delivered, I think, 600 men came up against one, and they did all that damage. They're like, dude, we're
out of here. There's a lot more where he comes from. Exactly. So Philistines, okay, now at this point, we're leaving Shamgar. He is now dead. We're about to introduce or show up with Deborah, and we have other bad guys showing up with her as we continue. So we're leaving the story at this point such that Moab is now subdued. the Mesopotamia or Syria, however you should argue it, is at least going to leave Israel alone for a while. The Philistines now control a large chunk of Dan and a small chunk of Judah's territory. All right, and we have just spanned about 130 years, roughly. Yeah. Of time when this occurred. Now, granted, this huge contrast to Joseph, which the few years of his life took many, many, many pages, we get 100 and some odd years in a matter of one chapter. So that's just the way the book of Judges is written until Samuel shows up, the last judge. Then it slows down a bit. Any questions? Did I miss anything? I hope I didn't miss anything.
Can I just say something, though, Dan?
Yes.
I think one of the reasons I love Return to the Hebrew Roots, you know, you've obviously liked the violence bit. but, you know, I love the fact that God is not as polite as we have made him. You find this in the churches. They sanitize scripture. But this whole play on what happened with the poop coming out of him and the smell,
yes,
you know? And then you pick it up with Elijah, with the prophets of Baal, because he says, what's the problem with your God? Is he busy relieving himself?
Yeah, exactly.
It really brings us down to our
human level.
Humanity.
Human, yes.
Isn't it refreshing? You know, being a believer is not pretty always. And we were saying this with Kathy the other day. We get into fights and we have to slam things through with one another. And back in that churchianity, it's like you don't mention stuff like that because you're going to look human.
Exactly.
Holy.
Exactly.
One kind of, but this is very holy.
It is.
It's very holy.
It is.
But it's real.